traditional Christmas tree. This new religion suited me, for it freed me from troublesome theological issues. I sat alone and watched the angels and shepherds enjoy their dancing. Commandant Suren approached my table, his Kris Kringle pillow belly bouncing as he walked.
"You're not eating, Fräulein Oberhäuser."
He slid his plate of meat and buttered potatoes onto the table. I turned my face away from the smell of the bloody beef. "It's Doktor, Herr Kommandant."
"You must keep your strength up. Meat has protein and iron, you know."
Why did it never occur to him not to lecture a doctor on nutrition?
"We're counting on you. I know it isn't easy with Fritz gone and Dr. Gebhardt off lecturing so much. And with the incident..."
Why did everyone refer to what happened with Halina as the incident? "I'm fine, Herr Kommandant." It was true. Chronic insomnia was common among concentration camp staffers. As Suren shook at least a jigger of salt onto his potatoes, Binz and her boyfriend Edmund kissed in the corner. It looked like an angel giving a shepherd mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Binz, recently promoted to deputy chief wardress at the camp, was not letting her new position disrupt her love life.
"I'd be better if we could manage the situation of the rabbits, Commandant," I said.
"I have a lot to deal with right now. 70 subcamps, all with their own problems. Siemens complaining the prisoners are dying at their benches. Besides, my hands are tied on the rabbit situation, Fräulein. Since Berlin slapped my wrist, I don't even receive reports about what's happening at my own camp. And Gebhardt doesn't communicate."
Suren had protested the sulfur operations, claiming he needed the Polish girls as workers. Gebhardt appealed to his friends in high places, and Suren was overruled. He was forced to apologize to Gebhardt face to face, a humiliating blow to his ego by all indications.
"So what is the latest?"
Suren asked, rolling a potato with his fork. He'd seen it all from his office, no doubt. Why did he need my version?
"Well, after the rabbits marched in protest..."
"Marched? Half of them can't walk."
"They were carried to the square and demanded to see Binz."
"I heard some of this pot."
"They handed her their manifesto, demanded in writing a halt to future operations."
"You're lucky it didn't incite a scuffle. So you operated anyway?"
"In the bunker this time. Couldn't use anesthesia down there, but we needed the extra security. The whole camp has become very protective of them."
"How can I help?"
"Berlin heard about the protest, and they are reviewing the situation. Gebhardt says there'll be no more rabbits at the shooting wall until further notice."
"So?"
Suren watched Binz and Edmund in their corner. I was losing him.
"If we can't make the results of this experiment go away, we may be the ones left holding the sack. Fritz is gone. Gebhardt's traveling."
That got his attention.
"I can't overrule Gebhardt, I'm afraid. He speaks to Himmler himself every day."
"Well, something must be done soon. If this leaks..."
Suren waved that thought away.
"Our security is near perfect. Only 3 escapes, and 2 of the escapees apprehended. Himmler himself complimented our sensors. They do not allow leaks."
This was a blatant falsehood. I'd heard all sorts of things got through our sensors. Binz found evidence of this daily. A bottle of hair dye in a box of rolled oats. Antibiotics in a toothpaste tube.
"Besides, the surgeries were performed in secret with the patients blindfolded. None of them can identify you."
"But..."
"Patience, my dear. I'll see to it the problem is addressed. Leave this to me."
Suren wandered off, leaving his napkin wadded up on his plate, beef blood seeping into the linen. As Binz's chorus of misshapen angels gathered to sing a medley of German folk songs, I felt my first shiver of fear about it all. I knew too well that loose ends tend to unravel.
Chapter 21. Caroline. Christmas, 1943. Any spare time I had that December, I spent chasing commuters at Grand Central Terminal, selling war bonds. Seemingly overnight, a 125-foot war-themed photo mural had sprung up on the station's eastern wall. Warships and fighter planes loomed over the sea of commuters, many of whom were in uniform themselves. The caption left no ambiguity as to the mission. Buy defense bonds and stamps now. One afternoon, one of the station's organists, Mary Lee Reed of Denver, who volunteered to play each holiday season, launched into a rousing version of the Star-Spangled Banner. This brought the main concourse to a standstill, all commuters holding hands to their hearts as they stood to listen, causing legions of missed trains. The station master asked Mary not to play that song again, and she became the only organist in New York ever barred from playing the United States national anthem. Security at Grand Central was tight, since two German spies had been caught trying to sabotage the station, but a small corps of volunteers, including Mother and me, were allowed in to sell bonds. All agreed Mother had missed her calling, for she was quite the rainmaker. Woe to the weary traveler who refused to part with at least 10 cents for a war stamp. For once in her thrall, they all ended up forcing additional funds on her, which she happily accepted. There were large numbers of women commuting through the station then. With so many men at war, women joined the workforce in droves. Even Betty had a job typing reports at the armory. Not exactly Rosie the Riveter, but it was a big step for her. Mother and I spent Christmas morning of 1943 at St. Thomas Church, not far from Grand Central Terminal at 5th Avenue and 53rd Street. We listened to Rector Brooks at his magnificent carved oak lectern, resplendent in his Christmas finery, as he did his best to lift our spirits. The war weighed heavily on the congregation, mostly women and older men at that point. There were a few uniformed servicemen in the pews, but most had been deployed to Europe or the Pacific Theater by then, including our elevator boy, Cuddy. Every one of us knew someone who'd been impacted by the war. I said a prayer for those aboard the French ship Roger had been forced to turn away the day before. Thousands of Europe's displaced seeking asylum, still waiting off the coast. I couldn't bear to count the months since I'd heard from Paul. Roger's best guess was that he was still at Natzweiler concentration camp. From what information I could gather, many Frenchmen had ended up there in the Vosges Mountains doing hard labor in extreme cold. Could anyone survive 2 years at such a place? That year, another development had surfaced, troubling and ominous. It was clear not only from the scanty reports we got from the Swiss Red Cross, but also from New York and London papers that Hitler was moving ahead with his plan to annihilate Jews, Slavs, Gypsies, and any other people he considered Untermenschen, subhumans, in order to make room for his Lebensraum. Reports of gas vans at Kelno, Poland, and mass exterminations had surfaced. Hitler even stated his plan openly in his ranting speeches. Yet Roosevelt was slow to react and kept immigration at a bare minimum. St. Thomas was our life raft of hope. Kneeling there in that great church, the air perfumed with frankincense, the magnificent stone altarpiece behind the altar, I felt the world might just untangle itself after all. When I was a child, Father and I began memorizing all 60 saints and famous figures carved in stone there. St. Polycarp, St. Ignatius, St. Cyprian. We'd made it to number 46, George Washington, when Father died, so I'd never learned the rest. Being there made me feel close to him, especially when the organist got all 1,551 of the organ's pipes playing God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, Father's favorite Christmas song. Just hearing the flush-cheeked choir boys sing of God's glory renewed one's sense of positivity. As Rector Brooks told us of his plans to enlist in the military and join the old 7th Regiment of New York as chaplain, I read the names cut into the wall of those who served in World War I. 20 of those, their names painted in gold, gave their lives for their country. How many more would we lose to this Second World War? Our parish had more than 400 members in uniform, and we had already surpassed World War I in the number of those mortally wounded. I'd snuck one of Paul's letters into my hymnal, a straggler that had arrived well after France had been invaded. I'd read and reread it so many times it had become thin as facial tissue. I read as Rector Brooks continued. Thank you, my love, for the packets of Ovaltine. Believe me, this is a welcome change from the hot beverage Rena's father makes from ground acorns. Do not be alarmed if this letter is my last for a short while. Every newspaper is predicting an invasion soon. But in the meantime, know that I miss you, and you are not outside my thoughts for more than a few minutes, and that is when I am asleep. Please keep us in your prayers, and sleep soundly on your pink satin sheets, knowing we will be at H&H Automat soon, enjoying the air conditioning and the apple. I felt someone's gaze and turned to find David Stockwell across the aisle from me, one pew back. He stared openly at me. What was that on his face? Curiosity? A bit of sadness? I closed my hymnal as Sally Stockwell, who even in the chill of the great hall appeared to be perspiring in earnest, leaned forward and smiled in my direction. Betty leaned forward as well and rolled her eyes for my benefit, a commentary on Rector Brooks's lengthy sermon. At the end of the service, Rector Brooks left the altar and followed a sparse procession of choir boys and old men. As they made their way down the center aisle, it was clear their ranks had been decimated, since many had gone off to war, trading their scarlet cassocks and white surplices for military uniforms. Once they made it to the rear of the church and back to the sacristy, the congregation began filtering out. Mother and I caught up with Betty, David, and Sally in the narthex of the church, the exquisite entryway with its lovely coffered ceiling. All three stood out in the crowd. Betty, since she wore a suit of pure white under her Denmark mink coat. Sally, since she was about to burst with twins, her crimson coat fighting a losing battle trying to cover her belly, and David, because he was practically the only man in Manhattan not in a uniform. He claimed his job at the State Department was an equal sacrifice. But compared to going to war, long lunches at 21 didn't seem a hardship. Mother and I reached the three as Sally fanned herself with a church program. "Oh, hello, Caroline," said Sally with a tremulous smile. "Looks like we'll have two Christmas babies," Mother said. "Three," Betty said. "Now it's triplets. Mother's having fits. She has to have three baby nurses lined up." It wasn't enough that the Dion quintuplets were on every billboard, reminding me of my own childlessness. Sally Stockwell had to be an overachiever as well. I took David by the elbow. "Can I speak to you? Privately?" David looked startled, afraid I wanted to discuss our past. Despite my still bruised feelings, I couldn't help but notice he seemed to be getting better looking with age. "I hope he's not in trouble," Betty said. "I can spare a minute," David said, "but we do need to get home. Cook has a roast on." I pulled David to a quieter corner, and he smiled. If this is a last-minute bid for my affections, maybe Church isn't.
Why won't you return my calls? I said. The war had not impeded David's ability to dress well. Classic, but almost to the edge of fop, his necktie arched, the pockets of his camel hair coat with perfectly swelled edges.
When was the last time you did me a favor?
I just need you to call someone about...
Only Congress can loosen immigration quotas, Caroline. I told you.
You're in a powerful position, David.
To do what?
Roger had to turn down another boat this morning, sailing from Le Havre. Half of them children. If you could just ask.
The country doesn't want more foreigners.
Foreigners? Half this country just got here a generation ago. How can you just let people die, David?
David took my hand. Look, see, I know Paul Rodier is over there in a bad situation.
I pulled my hand away. It's not that. How can we just do nothing? It's appalling.
Rector Brooks joined Mother, Betty, and Sally in the narthex. He waved his hand in a sign of the cross over Sally's belly, which only seemed to cause Sally to fan herself more.
We're at war, Caroline. Winning it is the best thing we can do for those people.
That's a smokescreen, and you know it. 70,000 Romanian Jews refused asylum here. The St. Louis turned away. How many innocents sent back to certain death?
Rector Brooks turned to look at us, and David pulled me farther into the shadows.
It's a slow process, Caroline. Every visa form must be perfectly vetted. Nazi spies might come here posing as refugees. It's in the best interests of the United States.
It's anti-Semitism, David. There was a time when you'd have done the right thing.
Brother dear, Betty called.
David held up an index finger to her. Let's admit what this is really all about. If you weren't pining away like a schoolgirl for your lost married boyfriend, you'd be back at the Junior League knitting socks for servicemen.
I'll forget you said that if you promise to at least try. David, now, Betty said.
Okay, I'll ask.
I have your word.
Yes, for God's sake. Are you happy?
I am, I said with a smile. For a moment, I thought I caught a flicker of sadness move across David's face. Regretting our breakup? It was hard to tell, for it retreated as quickly as it had come. We turned to see Mother and Betty ease Sally down into a back pew. Rector Brooks watched like an anxious father as Mother dispatched choir boys in search of a basin. Sally's cries echoed about the church as Mother wadded her coat to cushion the poor thing's head.
My God, David said, stricken. Betty ran to David and pulled his arm.
Get over here. She's about to erupt. No time to get to St. Luke's.
It seemed David would not be going home for cook's roast after all.
Chapter 22. Kasha. Christmas, 1943. Christmas of 1943 was an especially grim one for Zuzanna and me. With Matka and Luisa gone, and my sister wasted almost to nothing, there was little reason to celebrate. There'd been not one letter or package from Papa in so long. Was he even alive? We had off from Appel on Christmas afternoon, so the camp guards could have their celebration. Susanna lay next to me, so thin from dysentery one could see the sharp edge of her hip bone jut through the thin blanket as she slept. As a doctor, she knew what was happening and tried to instruct me on how to make her well, but even when the girls in the kitchen snuck her salt and clean water, nothing worked. Though many of our fellow prisoners shared their own precious food with all of the rabbits, without packages of our own from home, we had become living skeletons. Susanna lay on her side, hands clasped under her chin, and I dozed next to her, my chest to her back, her breath my only happiness. The women in our block had voted to allow us to have a bottom bunk to ourselves in light of our situation as rabbits. This was an extraordinary gesture, since some bunks hosted more than 8 prisoners. The Russian women, many of them doctors and nurses captured on the battlefield, were especially kind to us and had organized the vote. As a Christmas gift, Anise had given us a louse-free scrap of a blanket she'd taken from the booty piles, and I'd wound it around Susanna's bare feet. I watched a few Polish girls stuff some grass under a piece of cloth. This was a Christmas tradition we'd followed in Poland since we were young, where fresh straw is put under a white tablecloth. After supper, some maidens pull out blades of the straw from beneath the cloth to predict their future. A green piece predicts marriage. A withered one signifies waiting. A yellow one predicts the dreaded spinsterhood. And the very short one foreshadows an early grave. That day, they all looked very short to me. With Marzenka away for the moment, some Polish girls sang one of my favorite Christmas songs. Zdrow bądź królu anielski. As fit for the king of angels. In low, hushed tones, since singing or speaking in any language except German was forbidden, and could learn one in the bunker. The song took me back to Christmas Eve in Poland, our little tree covered with silver paper icicles and candles, exchanging gifts with Nadia, always books, dining on Matka's clear beetroot soup, hot fish and sweets, and going to church on Christmas Day, our family there in the same pew as the Bukowskis. All of us crowding in with Pietrik and his gentle mother, like a dark-haired swan. She'd been a ballet dancer before she met Pietrik's father, and always wore her hair gathered in a knot at the nape of her neck. Mr. Bukowski standing tall in his military uniform, and Luisa in her new pink coat snuggling close to me. His family smiling as Pietrik pulled me close to share a prayer book. His scent of cloves and cinnamon from helping his mother bake that morning. I spent more time in memories then. Anything to escape that freezing block. But I could feel the hunger taking the place of any love I had. Most of the day I thought only of bread and ridding Susanna and me of our lice. Susanna had developed a rigorous delousing routine for us, since she was terrified of typhus. As a doctor, she knew too well the consequences of contracting the disease. My thoughts were interrupted when the old electrician from Fürstenberg came to work on the wires in our block. He was a frequent visitor, and one whose presence was much anticipated. He stepped into the block, stooped and white-haired, toting his canvas bag of tools and a wooden folding stool. The shoulders and sleeves of his tweed coat dark with wet patches. He shook the rain off his mustard yellow hat and then did something he always did. Something extraordinary. He bowed to us. Bowed. How long had it been since anyone else had done this for us? He then walked to the center of the room and opened his folding stool. On the way he glanced at Susanna, asleep next to me, and smiled. For some reason, he seemed especially fond of Susanna. She had that effect on people. Did she remind him of his own child? On a previous visit, he'd snuck her a sugar cube, wrapped in white paper, that we made last for days, waking up at night to take little licks of it. And once he accidentally dropped the headache powder packet near her bunk. Why, you ask, would starving girls be happy to see this German man? Because Herr Fenstermacher was no ordinary workman. He was a kind, cultured man with a voice like warm molasses. But this was not the best thing. He sang for us, in French, but not just any songs. His own songs, made up of the newspaper headlines of the day. Yes, we knew about some war events just by listening to the distant thud of bombs to our south. But Herr Fenstermacher brought us, at great risk to himself, a gift more precious than gold. News of hope. The name Fenstermacher means window maker in German, and he was our window to the world. He always started the same way. He stepped upon his stool and fiddled with a bare light bulb and sang, "Recueillez près les filles, et vous entendrez tout ce qui se passe dans le monde." Gather near, girls, and you will hear all that is happening in the world. That Christmas day, he sang of American troops landing on European soil, of Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill meeting in Tehran, and of the British Royal Air Force successfully bombing Berlin. So that was who'd been flying overhead. I pictured handsome young English pilots in their planes, causing the air raid siren to sound, sending Binz and her Aufseherinnen into panic. Did those pilots even know we were down here waiting to be freed? Those who knew French whispered translations to the rest. You can't know how happy we were to get this gift. The electrician ended with a pretty, "Merry Christmas to you, dear ladies. May God help us all soon." He gathered his tool bag and settled his hat back on his head. Tears pricked at my eyes. Would he catch a chill in this weather? We'd been forgotten by everyone. Did he know he was our only ally? He walked by our bunk and tipped his hat to me. "Please take care," I thought. "You are our only friend." I was happy Susanna slept through it all. One day of rest, not having to stand in the sleet for hours as Binz and her guards counted us, would help her recover. It wasn't until Herr Fenstermacher was out the door and on his way that I saw what he'd left at the foot of our bunk. The most beautiful pair of hand-knitted socks. I reached for them and could not believe the softness. I stroked my cheek with them. They felt like Pshina's downy underfeathers. And the color, the palest blue like an early summer sky. I slid them down under Susanna's chin, between her clasped hands and her chest. A Christmas miracle. No sooner had Herr Fenstermacher left than the door to the block opened and Marzenka trudged in, stomping the mud off her boots. How we envied her boots, since bare feet in oversized wooden clogs in the middle of winter is a torture unto itself. Marzenka carried an armful of packages. My chest thumped at the sight of them. It was too much to ask for, a package for us on Christmas after waiting so long. She walked about the block, called out names and tossed packages and letters into some bunks. How strange, I thought, that we were allowed parcels, being political prisoners and all. But, lucky for us, Commandant Zürn was practical. A prisoner's family sending her food and clothing saved the camp money. It meant fewer funds were necessary to keep a worker alive. By the time Marzenka made it to our bunk, she only held two more parcels. "Please let one be ours." She slowed as she approached our bunk. "Merry Christmas," she said with a rare crack of a smile. Even she had become sympathetic to the rabbits. Marzenka lobbed the parcel onto our straw mattress, and it landed with a thump. I sat up and snatched it. I was a little dizzy and held the box wrapped in brown paper for a few moments, letting it all sink in. A package. Little splotches of rain had spotted the brown paper, giving it an animal skin look, and the rain smudged the ink of the return address. But it was from the Lublin Postal Center. Papa. Had he somehow cracked the code and ironed the letter? Should I wake Susanna so we could open it together? The package was already half open, having been rifled through by the censors, so I went ahead and pulled off the brown paper. I was left with an old candy tin, cold to the touch. I popped off the lid, and the smell of stale chocolate came up to meet me. Oh, chocolate. I'd forgotten about chocolate. Even stale chocolate made my mouth water. In the tin were three cloth-wrapped bundles. I unwrapped the first to reveal what was left of a poppy seed cake. More than half. Ordinarily, the censors would take a whole cake. Were they being generous since it was Christmas? I tasted a crumb and thanked God for creating the poppy flower, then wrapped it back up with haste, for I would save it for Susanna. Polish cake would be good medicine for her. The next bundle I unwrapped was a tube of toothpaste. I almost laughed. Our toothbrushes were long gone. But how wonderful it was to see something so familiar from home. I twisted off the cap and breathed in the cool peppermint. I tucked it under our mattress. With proper bartering, such a treasure would trade for a week's worth of extra bread. The last bundle was small and wrapped in Matka's little white kitchen towel, the one she'd cross-stitched with two kissing birds. Just seeing that sent me into choking sobs that delayed my progress, but I finally loosened the little bundle, hands shaking so hard I could barely untie the knot. Once the towel fell open and lay in my lap, all I could do was stare at the contents. It was a spool of red thread. Joy is an overused word, but that was what I felt there that day, knowing Papa had understood my secret letter. It was all I could do to keep from standing in the middle of the room and calling out with happiness. Instead, I kissed the little wooden spool and slipped it into my sleeping sister's clasped hands. That was the best Christmas in my life, for I knew we were no longer alone.
Chapter 23, Hertha, 1944.
Wilma Hartmann is here to see you, Nurse Marshall said with a knowing look. Why did she continue to enter my office without knocking?
I'd woken that morning in a foul mood and with a strange buzzing sound in my head. Maybe it was due to the fact that the camp was bursting at the seams. Ravensbrück had been built for 7,000 prisoners, but by that summer held close to 45,000. Maybe it was the constant air raid sirens or the ominous war news. In early June, word reached camp that the Americans had landed in France. Or maybe it was the fact that the camp was overrun with infectious prisoners, and every other week I had to cleanse the Riviera completely of patients not fit for work and send them on black transports. Even after a few cuts to relieve the tension, I still couldn't sleep. To make it all worse, Zuren had made no headway in the case of the rabbits. The blocks were so overcrowded and mismanaged, it would be impossible to find them without a camp-wide lockdown. Gerda told me their friends exchanged numbers with them and hid them everywhere, even in the TB block. I was in no mood to visit with old friends. Wilma Hartmann, a psychologist I had known at medical school, wanted to tour Uckermark, a nearby former youth camp for girls, where Zuren sent prisoner overflow. I knew psychologists did the rounds of the camps, checking the mental health of the camp staff. A waste of time when there were so many more important tasks. I hoped to take him to Uckermark, conduct his tour in 5 minutes or less, and be on my way without complications. I planned on an early evening and a cool tub, for we were in the middle of a heat wave. It was the hottest July on record. I found Wilma out in front of the administration building, waiting in the passenger side of a wagon.
I took the wheel, started the engine, and switched on the radio to discourage conversation.
Germany continues to be victorious. Allied supplies continue to dwindle as German troops continue Operation Watch on the Rhine. In other news...
Wilmer switched the radio off.
Victorious? Such lies. How can we delude ourselves? We've already lost the war. It was over back in Stalingrad.
So what brings you to camp, Wilma? The last time I saw you was in biology class. You were having a hard time with a fetal pig.
Wilmer smiled. That class almost did me in.
Wilmer was a good-looking man with a slight wave to his blonde hair and a gentle way. He wore civilian clothes, I assumed to gain the trust of the patients he spoke with. His expensive-looking pair of Cordovan brogues somehow stayed polished, even through the dust of the camp.
"The medical doctor path is not for everyone," I said. "It certainly pays better," Wilmer said, "but I'm happy being a psychologist."
Once we reached Uckermark, I parked, and Wilmer, a typical German gentleman, opened the wagon door for me. We surveyed the three newly built blocks and the enormous canvas army tent set up on the Platz, under which hundreds of Häftlings stood and sat, still in their civilian clothes. Wilmer had excellent manners, typical of a cultured German man, but was a dull sort. He'd asked me for a date once, but I'd been too busy to go.
"You publish so much, Wilmer. What a career you've made for yourself."
I brushed the sleeve of my white coat, for black ashes had collected there.
"It is too warm for long sleeves today, isn't it?" Wilmer said. "No need to dress formally for me."
"Why are you here, Wilmer?"
"Studying the connection between trauma and psychosis."
"Another study? You will have endless subjects here, starting with the officer's canteen."
"I'm more interested in the prisoners."
"Who cares about them? Don't touch them unless you want to catch something."
"I care very much," Wilmer said. "It's only part of my assignment, but through talk therapy with prisoners, I've learned a great deal."
"What's your official assignment?" I asked. We reached the tent, and Wilmer turned to smile at a Häftling.
"To evaluate the population's ability to contribute based on a variety of criteria."
What he meant was to cull those mentally unable to work. Before he marked them for special handling, he dabbled in a little research of his own.
"Observing the rats in the maze," I said, "I like to think it helps them to talk about it."
"Since when did you become so callous, Hertha?"
"Should I be on a couch for this?" "It would do you good. I'm not surprised, really. You have been systematically desensitized for years, after all, starting with medical school. I remember a sword fight with human limbs in the dissecting lab."
"And you are here to observe only prisoners?"
"Oh, no. Select camp staff as well."
"Does that include me?"
Wilmer shrugged. "We all have a job to do."
"So everything I say will be recorded and fed to Suren?"
"I report to Berlin."
"Did they tell you to evaluate me?"
"You are one of many, Hertha. The camp doctors are especially at risk. As a group, you show a deep respect for authority. You accept, even crave, the status quo."
"I can't live in a place so dirty as this." I brushed more cinders off my coat.
"What does my file say?" "You tell me."
"I'm sure the whole incident with the pole is in there."
"Perhaps."
"What is there to tell? I found a prisoner, a former nurse, who helped me transform the Revier. And Nurse Marshall became jealous and put an end to it. Marshall, there's one to study."
Do you know why they have you playing chess with Dr. Winkelmann?
We don't exactly chat about it, Wilma. Though I had at first railed against the forced visits with my rotund colleague Winkelmann, I had come to find them oddly relaxing. I dabbed mentholated jelly under my nose to fight his body odor and watched him eat an endless queue of fish sandwiches as he lectured me on the benefits of fish as brain food. I'd had worse dates. I assume they suspect I became overly close with another woman and would benefit from male company.
How do you feel about that?
It is not my job to feel. Internalizing your emotions won't help you, Hertha. Wilma was so soft with his sad brown cow eyes. Never the sharpest student. Medical school had been wasted on him. I was simply sad about it all. She was a hard worker and a good person.
My notes say you took to your bed for several days. Acute anxiety.
I got over it. Anything can be overcome with hard work and discipline. Why was he making such a production out of it all?
You seem upset that your jacket is becoming dirtied by the crema cinders. Care to talk about it?
I happen to prefer wearing a clean white coat, Wilma. Is that a violation of some behavioral rule?
No need to raise your voice, Hertha. Have the episodes become more frequent?
How much more did I have to take?
How are you sleeping?
Suddenly, it felt hot like hell standing out there in the sun. Not well, Wilma. Might have something to do with the 4 a.m. siren, not that anyone cares if I sleep.
You feel like no one cares? Wilma asked.
Would you stop asking me about feelings? Mein Gott, Wilma! What good does that do? How do I feel? How do I feel?
My raised voice attracted the attention of an Aufseherin. That was all I needed. More reports in my file.
Look, this is not an easy place to call home, Wilma said. Your chart indicates your camp responsibilities. You can't possibly be indifferent to it all. It's not in your nature to end lives, Hertha. You're no doubt experiencing psychic numbing.
I do my job, I said, pulling the sleeves of my dress down over my wrists.
Any more cutting?
What if there was? I could handle it.
No, of course not, I said. No cutting.
Wilmer put a cigarette to his lips and flicked open his lighter, the glint of sun on the aluminum case blinding me for a moment.
You can't have it both ways, Hertha. Kill and still be seen as a healer. It takes a toll.
On my time off, I think of other things.
That's doubling, you know. It's unhealthy.
So is smoking.
Wilmer winced and tossed his cigarette away, causing a scuffle among the heftlings.
Look, a certain amount of compartmentalizing is healthy, but you might be better off with the change of pace.
You are transferring me?
I think you could do with the change, yes. At this point, there isn't a lot you can do to help the Reich.
So you'll stick me in some small-town hospital ward with a tongue depressor and a bottle of aspirin?
You may not have taken your medical education seriously, but I have worked hard to get where I am.
No need for hostility, Hertha.
My dress was like a furnace, causing perspiration to roll down my back.
So now I am hostile? Please. Have you ever done something so well you think you are destined to do great things? No, don't write suffering from grandiosity on my chart. This is real. I am a medical doctor, Wilma. It is my oxygen. Please don't let them send me away.
This mess is not ending well for Germany, Hertha. You must see that. You will be in line for the gallows.
I started back to the wagon. Suren is managing things.
Wilma followed. You think Suren will protect you? He will make a run for Munich or Austria. Gebhard is already lobbying to have himself made president of the Red Cross, as if that will absolve him.
Why don't you just take a leave of absence? It was sickening. Such weakness. Had all Germans turned to jelly overnight? I will leave you to your research. I stepped back into the wagon and tossed him the bag of sandwiches we'd brought. I can handle this, Wilma. I have come this far. Please don't take it all away. As I drove out of the Uckermark gates, a truck passed me in the opposite direction, coming to pick up a special handling transport. I found Wilma in my rearview mirror, squatting near the tent, talking with some Hungarian Jews, chatting with them about their feelings, no doubt, as if that would help the Reich. A few months later, Zuren called me to his office, his face earthworm gray.
Our sources tell me news of Gepard's rabbits has leaked. Berlin intercepted a swift broadcast from the Polish government in exile in London that gave details of the rabbits. Called it vivisection and mentioned me by name. Binz, too. Said our crimes will be avenged with a red-hot poker.
Any doctors mentioned?
Just Gepard. They said a Catholic mission in Freiburg sent word to the Vatican.
I told you, Commandant.
He paced. How did word leak? We were so careful. I suppose we need to make sure those rabbits are well tended then.
No, Commandant, just the opposite. As we discussed...
The security office says the Polish government in exile has condemned Gepard to death, you know. This is international opinion we are dealing with. Must be handled carefully. It can make a difference once things are, well, over.
It's better if the rabbits are never found. Hard for public opinion to comment on something that never existed.
But Himmler is talking to Sweden about transporting heftlings out of here. To Sweden in Red Cross buses. Thinks it might encourage leniency. Perhaps this will help us. I hope it is well noted that I objected to the operations.
How could Zuren be so naive? There would be no leniency. If Germany lost the war, the victors would not exactly be lining up asking who had objected to what. Zuren would head straight for the gallows.
Do you think the world will look kindly on that walking evidence of what went on here?
Commandant, you will be held responsible no matter what you say.
Me too.
Zuren looked out his window over the camp below.
How do we find them? Heftlings are not going by their real numbers anymore.
His eyes were bloodshot. Had he been drinking?
At Appell, they just slip away. They exchange numbers with the dead.
I stepped closer to him. Most should be in Block 31, or hiding underneath, with a new facility.
Please, Oberhäuser.
Zuren didn't like to talk about the new facility, and certainly no one spoke the word gas. His new staff members, just arrived from Auschwitz, had helped him cobble together a makeshift facility in an old painter's shed next to the Crema. Not fine workmanship, but it would make the whole business of silencing the rabbits much simpler.
I will have been secure that block and then call Appell, said Zuren. You will personally see to it that each rabbit is caught.
It was about time. Are you giving me permission to...
Do what you need to, Doctor. Just make sure no trace of them is found.
Chapter 24. Caroline. 1944 to 1945. On August 25th, Roger phoned me up at the Hay and said the Free French and American troops were at the outskirts of Paris. We were back in business. It was a Saturday, so traffic was light as I drove into the city with the gas pedal to the floor, screeching by cars on the Taconic Parkway, until I saw blue flashing lights in my rearview mirror. Once I told the baby-faced officer the circumstances, he turned on his flashing lights and escorted me to the consulate. In Roger's office, we grabbed information from every source we could. We read telegrams and cables and listened to the radio all at once. When our troops made it to the Arc de Triomphe, we were overcome with joy and on the phone with Bordeaux and London. The U.S. troops, accompanied by General de Gaulle and the Free French Army, marched into Paris from the south along the Champs-Élysées in jeeps and on foot. Hordes of Parisians surged into the streets shouting, "Vive la France!" People streamed out of their homes, frantic with the joy of liberation, even while German snipers and tanks still fired here and there. Soon, the Germans waved white flags of surrender from behind their bunkers. Restaurateurs brought their last few bottles of champagne out of the cellars, and Paris went mad with happiness. Later that day, we watched from Roger's office as Lily Pons, the Metropolitan Opera star, sang La Marseillaise to 30,000 people gathered below us on Rockefeller Plaza to celebrate the victory. We all agreed it was just a matter of time before Hitler capitulated and Berlin fell. The Allies would liberate all of the concentration camps. I sent telegrams and letters to possible repatriation centers across France, inquiring about Paul. How would he get back to Paris? Though France had been liberated, the war dragged on. I sat at the dining room table up at the Hay the following April, still in my pajamas, writing a press release for orphans in freed France. These common things are most urgently needed in France today. Rice, sweetened cocoa, powdered whole milk, dried fruits, tea and coffee for older children are next in importance. How long had it been since I'd had that first letter from Paul? None of my inquiries had borne fruit. One last snowstorm had hit Bethlehem, but even winter was tired of winter, and quiet flakes covered the crusty snow in the yard like white flannel. Terrible snowball snow, Father would have called it. Sergei threw the mail he'd picked up from the post office onto the half-moon table near the front door with a thump and went about shoveling the front walk. I made tea in the kitchen as the afternoon grew dark. On my way back to the dining room, I flipped through the mail stack. I found the usual envelopes, a flyer for Mother's annual Spring Bethlehem Horse Show held on Faraday Field behind our house to benefit the library, the monthly Elmwood Farm milk bill, an invitation to a handbell concert at the Grange. One envelope stopped me in my tracks. It was Ecru, just like the others he had sent, addressed in Paul's handwriting, somewhat less crisp and strong, but unmistakably his. The return address read, Hotel Lutetia, 45, Boulevard Raspail. My hands shook as I ripped the side of the envelope and read the letter's contents. I grabbed my boots from the kitchen, threw Mother's coat on over my pajamas, and ran across the front yard to Merrill Brothers' general store, cracking through the top crusty layer of snow with each step. I bounded up the stairs and found Mother standing near a wall of shelves with Mr. Merrill, a clear bottle of witch hazel in her hand. They separated, startled. Mr. Merrill smiled when I entered, a porcupine of keys at his waist.
"Caroline, how have you been?"
"Not now, Mr. Merrill," I said, grabbing the door jamb as I tried to catch my breath. Though generally a concise man, handsome Mr. Merrill would discuss the pros and cons of the paper grocery bag ad infinitum if even slightly encouraged. Mother turned.
"Good Lord! What is it, dear?"
Unable to catch my breath, I waved the envelope. Mother stepped to the door.
"Close this, Caroline. For goodness sakes, what is wrong with you?"
"It's from Paul. He's at..."
At where, dear?
The Hotel Lutetia.
Why didn't you say so, Caroline? She said, handing the witch hazel back to Mr. Merrill. We'll go tomorrow.
After all, our bags had been packed for months.
Chapter 25, Kasha, 1945. Beauty Road was no longer beautiful come February 1945. The Germans used the window boxes and many of the linden trees for firewood. The road's black slag was covered with frozen slush, and snow was still piled high about the camp, a layer of ash collected atop it, fallout from the furnaces. The cage of exotic animals was long gone. I dodged groups of women out, braving the cold, some in gangs, some wandering alone. On Sundays, Beauty Road teemed with a rowdy jumble of women of all nationalities, some carrying a rinsed pair of bloomers or a uniform shift between them, airing it out to dry. The camp had become impossibly crowded as the Red Army pushed west across Poland, and transports of prisoners the Germans evacuated from concentration camps like Auschwitz and Majdanek arrived hourly. We soon had prisoners from 22 countries. Poles were still by far the largest group, but we now had among us British prisoners, Chinese, Americans. Everyone knew Himmler kept many of his prominente, special prisoners in the bunker, including an American pilot who'd been found near Ravensbrück, having parachuted from his failing plane. Though most of us wore the same blue and gray striped uniforms, we could guess a prisoner's nationality by the way she wore hers. You could always tell a French girl. Each tied her kerchief in a unique, charming way, and they all sewed chic little bags called bolis from organized scraps to hold their mess kits. Some even stitched little white collars onto their uniform shifts and made lovely bows from rags. The Russian prisoners, many of them Red Army nurses and doctors captured on the battlefield, were unmistakable as well. They were a disciplined group, and all wore their camp uniforms in exactly the same way. Each had kept her Russian-issued leather army boots and wore the camp headscarf tied in a perfect square knot at the nape of her neck. It was easy to recognize newly arrived prisoners to the camp. Once camp authorities ran out of uniforms, new prisoners wore a crazy assortment of mismatched clothing taken from the booty piles. They looked like exotic birds in their parrot frocks, as we called them, a gaudy mix of ruffled skirts and bright blouses. Some were lucky enough to find warm men's jackets, all chalked by camp staff with a big white St. Andrew's cross across the back, in case the wearer escaped. Two Russian girls stood at their makeshift store between blocks 29 and 31, where one could buy a sweater or stockings or a comb for the price of a bread ration. Their lookout stood close by, alert for signs of Vince. Rumor was Gemma LaGuardia Gluck, sister of New York City's Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, was our fellow prisoner. A group of female British paratroopers captured by the SS in France, too. Charles de Gaulle's niece, Genevieve. And everyone knew Himmler's own sister had been a Ravensbrück prisoner, arrested for race defilement, relations with a Polish man. The girls in the front office said even she was not spared the 25 lashes that came with her sentence. Beans turned up the music that was playing throughout the camp even higher and pelted us with war songs and marches. I looked to the sky as three planes flew overhead. German. I could tell by the sound of the engines and the lack of an air raid siren. The previous summer we'd heard about the Normandy invasion, thanks to Herr Fenstermacher, but no one needed to tell us Germany was rapidly losing the war. The signs were everywhere. Daily air raids. Shorter appels. Fewer work details. The Nazis were giving up. They did not give up killing us, though. The windowless black transport buses came to the blocks with new urgency. Fat Dr. Winkelmann in his long leather coat and his partner